Hey, this is Anya.
And this is Peter.
And we're from Rock and Roll High School every first and third Wednesday at 8 p.m.
And you're listening to WGXC, Acre, Hudson, Catskill, 90.7 FM, radio for open ears, baby. Wow.
On October 28th, two incredible performers come to the Hudson Valley. Meg Baird and Chris Forsyth are both performing at Tubby's in Kingston. And they're both playing with the same band, Douglas McCombs from Tortoise and 11th Dream Day on bass, Ryan Jewell, who plays with Riley Walker and many others on drums, and Charlie Soffley from Heron Oblivion on guitar will be backing both Meg Baird from Espers and Chris Forsyth. Performance is October 28th from 8 to 11 p.m. at Tubby's in Kingston. You can find out more about this show and many others on the WGXC community calendar online at wgxc.org.
Like a fire hydrant, like a public drinking fountain, like a park bench, WGXC is always there for you, at your service. 90.7 FM, community radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, friends and enemies. You're listening to me, your host, Norman Douglas, and the show is Good Night, Norman. Tonight, I'm going to read a fairy tale by the author James Stevens. Irish national, early 20th century. This is from a collection called Irish Fairy Tales. The Enchanted Cave of Kesh Koran. Fionn Mac, I have to make one caveat here. I do not read or speak Gaelic or Celtic or whatever it is, so I may mispronounce several names here. That said, the Enchanted Cave of Kesh Koran. Fionn Mac Whail was the most prudent chief of an army in the world, but he was not always prudent on his own account. Discipline sometimes irked him, and he would then take any opportunity that presented for an adventurer, for he was not only a soldier, he was a poet also. That is, a man of science, and whatever was strange or unusual had an irresistible attraction for him. Such a soldier was he, that single-handed he could take the Fianna out of any hole they got into. But such an inveterate poet was he, that all the Fianna together could scarcely retrieve him from the abysses into which he tumbled. It took him to keep the Fianna safe, but it took all the Fianna to keep their captain out of danger. They did not complain of this, for they loved every hair of Fionn's head more than they loved their wives and children. And that was reasonable, for there was never in the world a person more worthy of love than Fionn. Gollum MacMurnagh did not admit so much in words, but he admitted it all in his actions, for although he never lost an opportunity of killing a member of Fionn's family, there was deadly feud between Clan Vaishni and Clan Mornagh. Yet a call from Fionn brought Gull raging to his assistance, like a lion that rages tenderly by his mate. Not even a call was necessary, for Gull felt in his heart when Fionn was threatened, and he would leave Fionn's own brother, only half-killed, to fly where his arm was wanted. He was never thanked, of course, for although Fionn loved Gull, he did not like him, and that was how Gull felt towards Fionn. Fionn, with Conan the Swearer and the dogs Bran and Sholan, was sitting on the hunting mound at the top of Kesh Karan. Below and around on every side, the Fianna were beating the coverts in Legni and Brefni, ranging the fastnesses of Glen Dalan, creeping in the nut and beech forests of Carberry, spying among the woods of Cael Conor, and ranging the wide plain of Moy Conal. The great captain was happy. His eyes were resting on the sights he liked best, the sunlight of a clear day, the waving trees, the pure sky, the lovely movement of the earth. And his ears were filled with delectable sounds, the baying of eager dogs, the clear calling of young men, the shrill whistling that came from every side, and each sound of which told a definite thing about the hunt. There was also the plunge and scurry of the deer, the yapping of badgers, and the whir of birds driven into reluctant flight. Now the king of the Shi of Kesh Koran, Conoran, son of Imadel, was also watching the hunt. But Fionn did not see him, for we cannot see the people of Faerie until we enter their realm. And Fionn was not thinking of Faerie at that moment. Conoran did not like Fionn, and seeing that the great champion was alone, save for Conan and the two hounds Bran and Sholan, he thought the time had come to get Fionn into his power. We do not know what Fionn had done to Conoran, but it must have been bad enough, for the king of the Shi of Kesh Kotran was filled with joy at the sight of Fionn thus close to him, thus unprotected, thus unsuspicious. This Conoran had four daughters. He was fond of them and proud of them, but if one were to search the Shees of Ireland or the land of Ireland, the equal of these four would not be found for ugliness and bad humor and twisted temperament. Their hair was black as ink and tough as wire. It stuck up and poked out and hung down about their heads in bushes and spikes and tangles. Their eyes were bleary and red. Their mouths were black and twisted. And in each of these mouths there was a hedge of curved yellow fangs. They had long, scraggy necks that could turn all the way round like the neck of a hen. Their arms were long and skinny and muscular, and at the end of each finger they had a spiked nail that was as hard as horn and as sharp as a briar. Their bodies were covered with a bristle of hair and fur and fluff, so that they looked like dogs in some parts, and like cats in others, and in other parts again, they looked like chickens. They had mustaches poking under their noses and woolly wads growing out of their ears, so that when you looked at them the first time, you never wanted to look at them again, and if you had to look at them a second time, you were likely to die of the sight. They were called Caobag, Quien and Yaran. The fourth daughter, Yarnak, was not present at that moment, so nothing need be said of her yet. Conoran called these three to him. Fionn is alone, said he. Fionn is alone, my treasures. Ah, said Caobag, and her jaw crunched upwards and stuck outwards, as was usual with her when she was satisfied. When the chance comes, take it, Conoran continued, and he smiled a black, beetle-browed, unbenevolent smile. It's a good word, quoth Guyen, and she swung her jaw loose and made it waggle up and down, for that was the way she smiled. And here is the chance, her father added. The chance is here, Yaron echoed with a smile that was very like her sister's, only that it was worse. And the wind that grew on her nose joggled to and fro and did not get its balance again for a long time. Then they smiled, a smile that was agreeable to their own eyes, but which would have been a deadly thing for anybody else to see. But Fionn cannot see us, Kaobug objected, and her brow set downwards, and her chin set upwards, and her mouth squeezed sidewards, so that her face looked like a badly disappointed nut. And we are worth seeing, Guyen continued, and the disappointment that was set in her sister's face got carved and twisted into hers, but it was worse in her case. That is the truth, said Yaron in a voice of lamentation, and her face took on a gnarl and a writhe and a solidity of ugly woe that beat the other two and made even her father marvel. He cannot see us now, Conoran replied, but he will see us in a minute. Won't Fionn be glad when he sees us, said the three sisters. And then they joined hands and danced joyfully around their father and sang a song, the first line of which is Fionn thinks he is safe, but who knows when the sky will fall? Lots of the people in the Shi learned that song by heart, and they applied it to every kind of circumstance. By his arts, Conoran changed the sight of Fionn's eyes, and he did the same for Conan. In a few minutes, Fionn stood up from his place on the mound. Everything was about him as before, and he did not know that he had gone into Faerie. He walked for a minute up and down the hillock. Then, as by chance, he stepped down the sloping end of the mound and stood with his mouth open, staring. He cried out, "Come down here, Conan, my darling," and Conan stepped down to him. "Am I dreaming?" Fionn demanded, and he stretched out his finger before him. "If you are dreaming," said Conan, "I'm dreaming too." "They weren't here a minute ago," he stammered. Fionn looked up at the sky and found that it was still there. He stared to one side and saw the trees of Cael Conor waving in the distance. He bent his ear to the wind and heard the shouting of hunters, the yapping of dogs, and the clear whistles which told how the hunt was going. "Well," said Fionn to himself, by my hand," quoth Conan to his own soul. And the two men stared into the hillside as though what they were looking at was too wonderful to be looked away from. "Who are they?" said Fionn. "What are they?" Conan gasped. And they stared again, for there was a great hole like a doorway in the side of the mound, and in that doorway the daughters of Conoran sat spinning. They had three crooked sticks of holly set up before the cave, and they were reeling yarn off these, but it was enchantment they were weaving. "One could not call them handsome," said Conan. "One could," Fionn replied, "but it would not be true." "I cannot see them properly," Fionn complained. "They are hiding beyond the holly." "I would be contented if I could not see them at all," his companion grumbled. But the chief insisted, "I want to make sure that it is whiskers they are wearing." "Let them wear whiskers or not wear them," Conan counseled. "But let us have nothing to do with them. One must not be frightened of anything," Fionn stated. "I am not frightened," Conan explained. "I only want to keep my good opinion of women, and if the three yonder are women, then I feel sure I shall begin to dislike females from this minute out." "Come on, my love," said Fionn, "for I must find out if these whiskers are true." He strode resolutely into the cave. He pushed the branches of holly aside and marched up to Conoran's daughters. with Conan behind him. The instant they passed the holly, a strange weakness came over the heroes. Their fists seemed to grow heavy as lead and went dingle-dangle at the ends of their arms. Their legs became as light as straws and began to bend in and out. Their necks became too delicate to hold anything up, so that their heads wibbled and wobbled from side to side. "What's wrong at all?" said Conan as he tumbled to the ground. "Everything is," Fionn replied, and he tumbled beside him. The three sisters then tied the heroes with every kind of loop and twist and knot that could be thought of. "Those are whiskers," said Fionn. "Alas," said Conan, "what a place you must hunt whiskers in," he mumbled savagely. "Who wants whiskers?" he groaned. But Fionn was thinking of other things. "If there was any way of warning the Fianna not to come here," Fionn murmured.
"There is no way, my darling," said Kaivog, and she smiled a smile that would have killed Fionn, only that he shut his eyes in time.
After a moment, he murmured again, "Conan, my dear love, give the warning whistle so that the Fianna will keep out of this place." A little woof, like the sound that would be made by a baby and it asleep, came from Conan. "Fionn," said he, "there isn't a whistle in me." "We are done for," said he.
"You are done for indeed," said Quien,
and she smiled a hairy and twisty and fangy smile that almost finished Conan. By that time, some of the Fianna had returned to the mound to see why Bran and Sholan were barking so outrageously. They saw the cave and went into it, but no sooner had they passed the holly branches than their strength went from them, and they were seized and bound by the vicious hags. Little by little, all the members of the Fianna returned to the hill, and each of them was drawn into the cave, and each was bound by the sisters. Oisin and Oscar and Mac Lugat came, with the nobles of Clan Bajni, and with those of Clan Corcoran and Clan Shmuel. They all came, and they were all bound. It was a wonderful sight and a great deed, this binding of the Fianna, and the three sisters laughed with a joy that was terrible to hear and was almost death to see. As the men were captured, they were carried by the hags into dark, mysterious holes and black, perplexing labyrinths.
"Here is another one," cried Kaivog as she bundled a trussed champion along.
"This one is fat," said Quien, and she rolled a bulky Fenian along like a wheel.
"Here," said Yaron, "is a love of a man. One could eat this kind of man," she murmured, and she licked a lip that had whiskers growing inside as well as out.
And the corded champion whimpered in her arms, for he did not know, but eating might indeed be his fate, and he would have preferred to be coffined anywhere in the world rather than be coffined inside of that face. So far for them. Within the cave there was silence, except for the voices of the hags and the scarcely audible moaning of the Fianna Fin. But without there was a dreadful uproar, for as each man returned from the chase, his dogs came with him. And although the men went into the cave, the dogs did not. They were too wise. They stood outside, filled with savagery and terror, for they could scent their masters and their masters' danger, and perhaps they could get from the cave smells till then unknown and full of alarm. From the troop of dogs there arose a baying and barking, a snarling and howling and growling, a yelping and squealing and bawling for which no words can be found. Now and again a dog nosed among a thousand smells and scented his master. The ruff of his neck stood up like a hog's bristles, and a netty ridge prickled along his spine. Then with red eyes, with bared fangs, with a hoarse, deep snort and growl, he rushed at the cave, and then he halted and sneaked back again with all his ruffles smoothed, his tail between his legs, his eyes screwed sideways in miserable apology and alarm.
and a long, thin whine of woe dribbling out of his nose. The three sisters took their wide-channeled, hard-tempered swords in their hands and prepared to slay the Fianna. But before doing so, they gave one more look from the door of the cave to see if there might be a straggler of the Fianna who was escaping death by straggling. And they saw one coming towards them with Bran and Sholan leaping beside him, while all the other dogs began to burst their throats with barks and split their noses with snorts and wag their tails off at sight of the tall, valiant, white-toothed champion, Gol Mor Mac Morna.
"We'll kill that one first," said Khai Vaagh.
"There's only one of him," said Quien, "and each of us three is the match for 100, said Yaron. The uncanny, misbehaved, and outrageous Haradins advanced then to meet the son of Morna, and when he saw these three, Gull whipped the sword from his thigh, swung his buckler round, and got to them in 10 great leaps. Silence fell on the world during that conflict. The wind went down. The cloud stood still. The old hill itself held its breath. The warriors within ceased to be men and became each an ear, and the dogs sat in a vast circle round the combatants, with their heads all to one side, their noses poked forward, their mouths half open, their tails forgotten. Now and again a dog whined in a whisper and snapped a little snap on the air, but except for that there was neither sound nor movement. It was a long fight. It was a hard and a tricky fight, and Gull won it by bravery and strategy and great good luck. For with one shrewd slice of his blade he carved two of these mighty termagants into equal halves, so that there were noses and whiskers to his right hand and knees and toes to his left. And that stroke was known afterwards as one of the three great sword strokes of Ireland. The third hag, however, had managed to get behind Gull, and she leaped onto his back with the bound of a panther and hung there with the skillful, many-legged, tight-twisted clutching of a spider. But the great champion gave a twist of his hips and a swing of his shoulders that whirled her around him like a sack. He got her on the ground and tied her hands with the straps of a shield. He was going to give her the last blow when she appealed to his honor and bravery.
"I put my life under your protection," said she, "and if you let me go free, I will lift the enchantment from the Fianna Fin and give them all back to you again."
"I agree to that," said Gull, and he untied her straps. The Haradin did as she had promised, and in a short time Fionn and Oisin and Oscar and Conan were released, and after that all the Fianna. As each man came out of the cave, he gave a jump and a shout. The courage of the world went into him, and he felt that he could fight 20. But while they were talking over the adventure and explaining how it had happened, a vast figure strode over the side of the hill and descended among them. It was Conaran's fourth daughter. If the other three had been terrible to look on, this one was more terrible than the three together. She was clad in iron plate. She had a wicked sword by her side and a knobby club in her hand. She halted by the bodies of her sisters, and bitter tears streamed down into her beard.
"Alas, my sweet one," said she, "I am too late."
And then she stared fiercely at Fionn. "I demand a combat," she roared. It is your right," said Fionn. He turned to his son. "Oisin, my heart, kill me this honorable hag." But for the only time in his life, Oisin shrank from combat. "I cannot do it," he said. "I feel too weak." Fionn was astounded. "Oscar," he said, "will you kill me this great hag?" Oscar stammered miserably. "I would not be able to," he said.
Macronan also refused, and so did Kailti Macronan and Maclugac, for there was no man there but was terrified by the sight of that mighty and valiant Haradan. Fionn rose to his feet. "I will take this combat myself," he said sternly. And he swung his buckler forward and stretched his right hand to the sword. But at that terrible sight, Gul Maimurna blushed deeply and leaped from the ground. "No, no," he cried. "No, my soul, Fionn, this would not be a proper combat for you. I take this fight." "You have done your share, Gul," said the captain. "I should finish the fight I began," Gul continued, "for it was I who killed the two sisters of this valiant hag. It is against me her feud lies." "That'll do for me," said the horrible daughter of Conoran. "I will kill Gul Mor Macmorna first, and after that I will kill Fionn, and after that I will kill every Fenian of the Fianna Fin. You may begin." "Gul," said Fionn, "and I give you my blessing." Gul then strode forward to the fight. The hag moved against him with equal alacrity. In a moment the heavens rang to the clash of swords on bucklers. It was hard to stand with the terrific blows of that mighty female, for her sword played with the quickness of lightning and smoked like the heavy crashing of a storm. But into that din and encirclement, Gul pressed and ventured, steady as a rock in water, agile as a creature of the sea. And when one of the combatants retreated, it was the hag that gave backwards. As her foot moved, a great shout of joy rose from the Fianna. A snarl went over the huge face of the monster, and she leaped forward again. But she met Gul's point in the road. It went through her, and in another moment Gul took her head from its shoulders and swung it on high before Fionn. As the Fianna turned homewards, Fionn spoke to his great champion and enemy. "Gul," he said, "I have a daughter." "A lovely girl, a blossom of the dawn," said Gul. "Would she please you as a wife?" the chief demanded. "She would please me," said Gul. "She is your wife," said Fionn. But that did not prevent Gul from killing Fionn's brother Kyrell later on, nor did it prevent Fionn from killing Gul later on again. And the last did not prevent Gul from rescuing Fionn out of hell when the Fianna Fin were sent there under the new god. Nor is there any reason to complain or to be astonished at these things, for it is a mutual world we live in, a give-and-take world, and there is no great harm in it. You're listening to Good Night, Norman. You're live in WGXC Hudson Community Radio, 90.7 FM, WGXC.org on the world wide webimajig. That was a story by James Stevens. It was called The Enchanted Cave of Keshkaran, from his collection Irish Fairy Tales, I think around 1920. This is another old dead guy. He didn't live very long. Marcel Schwab, born 1867, died in 1905. So he was like 28 when he was dead. But I like his stuff. Okay. This one is called Sorry if that's making a lot of noise. This one is called Bloody Blanche. It's from a collection translated by Kit Schluter. The title of it is The King and the Golden Mask. Bloody Blanche, or Blanche, I guess, to Paul Marguerite. After Guillaume de Flavie had grown weary of war and politics, he wanted to augment his fortune by taking a wife. He was a tall man and strong, broad-shouldered, of heavy and hairy breast. Laying his hands on two armed knights, he could make them crumple to the ground. He would put on his gaiters and tromp through the muck of the glebe, slapping his meaty palm on the backs of the mud-encrusted men hunched in the furrows. His square face was always flush from the blood pounding in his temples, and the bones of meat shattered between his teeth. Near Reims, he saw one day while riding along the edge of his meadows, the fields of Robert d'Aubrebrouckeur. He dismounted and entered the great hall of the house. The chests lined up against the walls were spacious, fit for hiding bodies, and had a dingy air about them. The work table was unstable. The iron of the fireplace rusted, the spit caked in half an inch of char. One saw here and there a cobbler's apron, awls, and flat hammer. And in one corner, a cross-legged man was busy pulling a needle through a shirt of thick fabric. But squatting on the stones of the hearth with a surprised, lucid expression and golden hair scattered around her pale face, a little girl had turned her head toward Guillaume de Flavie. She could have been 10 years old. Her chest was flat, her limbs willowy, her hands slight, and her mouth was that of a woman slashed into her pale face like a bloody wound. It was Blanche d'Aubrebrouck. Her father had become, a few days prior by succession, the Viscount de Vassy. With rounded back, long beard, and hands made skilled simply from tools, he would assume, as he considered his fiefdoms, the surprised and disquieted aspect of a man who was handling something dangerous. The English horseman Jacques de Bethune, in service of Luxembourg, had already come asking for the girl's hand, and her father, uncertain, thought he might await a more ideal situation. The inherited lands were burdened with a debt of 300,000 écus. The former Viscount de Vassy himself owed personally a good 10,000 of them, but perhaps the Englishmen or Luxembourgers would take care of that. In the end, it was Guillaume de Flavie who made off with little Blanche. He settled the debts to keep the land. Having wed her by law, he promised to postpone their true wedding for 3 years. And so, this man of estimable appearance laid his hands on the fiefdoms of Assy, and on a lank, wild, and childish being. 3 months later, little Blanche, her brow furrowed and eyes pale, was already wandering the castle like a sick cat, having known the cruel espousals of Guillaume de Flavie. She did not understand. She could not understand. She was of such a different age and body. The man was hard on her, as he was with his barber. After wiping his mouth at the table with the back of his hand, he would throw his leftover meats in this obsequious barber's face. He shouted and swore without end, succumbing to the governance of his wine and victuals. He would send back the plates before him, leaving Blanche's father and mother at the two ends of the table, a mother who had already had a shaky head and bones which formed coins on her body. time, almost without eating, almost without speaking, old, unintelligible, then turned pallid and passed away. The father, having weakened as if he had taken poison, signed the deeds for Flavie after drinking. He had abandoned the lands burdened with debts and rubbed his hands together, humming for his handsome annuity. But no longer eating, he demanded his money, screamed pitifully. The poor frightened creature wrote out in a shaky script a list of complaints to the king. Guillaume swept up the papers in passing. The old man groaned. The servants threw him down in a dungeon, and opening it to the sunlight a month later, they found a desiccated corpse, its teeth sunken into a shoe whose toe had been gnawed away by rats. Little Blanche grew extraordinarily fond of eating. She ate enough sweets to catch her death of them, and stuffed her bloody mouth with round buns and cream. Hunched over the table, her eyes close to the meats, she devoured quickly, with a limpid expression. Then she would take great swigs of the wine, Bino and Morillon alike, tossing her head back. A wave of pleasure washed visibly across her face. She would spill goblets of wine into her wide-open mouth, hold it there without swallowing, puffing out her cheeks, and shoot it, like a fountain, into the guests' faces. Staggering around after meals, she would stand up and, possessed by the wine, lean against the wall, like a man. Her ways pleased the bastard of Oban Dach, black and nefarious, whose eyebrows met in a line above his nose. He came often to Flavie, who was his kin, and whose lands he hastily awaited, being supple and vigorous, with calves of steel and strong fists. He would eye with sardonic airs Guillaume's heavy body, but this left little Blanche unmoved, so from then on he spoke tactfully to her of her dresses, showed surprise when he saw her still in her wedding outfit, where he found she had since grown, pointed out young bourgeois girls in scarlet dresses, of maline or fine fair, with supple gray linings, big sleeves, hoods from whose pitchers hung green or red silk, which dragged on the ground. She listened as if he were describing a puppet's outfit, and the bastard of Dobon Duck toasted her with glass in hand and made her laugh and drink and gave her sweets, ridiculing her husband, such that he splashed his wine like a bashing bird beating its wings in a brimming egg rut. The bodies whose long face bore masks from some leg of lamb, the barber whose long face bore marks from some leg of lamb, sided with them, and he and the bastard put their heads together. They conspired to take the castle, that it would be the bastard's, the woman being at the mercy of each in her innocence, provided she would have the key to the cellar and pantry. One night, Guillaume de Flavie, tripping on the threshold, bludgeoned his face. He gave himself a cut that opened his cheek and bone. He cried out for the barber, who almost immediately brought him anointed bandages. Over the course of the night, Guillaume's face swelled up. His skin grew pale and taut, streaked with brown. His bulging eyes shed endless tears, and his wound took on the heinous aspect of tenderized meat. He stayed in his armchair all morning, howling in pain, Little Blanche seemed terrified, so terrified, in fact, that she forgot to drink. And she watched Guillaume from the other end of the room with her translucent eyes, while her hands, her mouth, so red, wriggled feebly. Scarcely had Guillaume gone upstairs to bed, attended by his horseman, Bastouin, when the castle began to stir with a thousand quiet sounds. Blanche listened on, her ear to the door, one finger over her lips. She could hear the dull blows of hauberks. The mused clashing of weaponry, the creaking grill of the enormous gate, a strange crackling in the hall, the unsteady flickers of many a lantern came and went. Meanwhile, the resin torches in the great hall where the meat was still laid out burned with a straight single flame and long nets of smoke. The calm air. Blanche walked quietly up the stairs with childlike steps to her husband's bedroom. He was sleeping on his back, his swollen face covered in bandages, turned up toward the joists. Bastouin left, for it was time for Blanche to get into bed. She sidled under the sheets, took the hideous head in her arms and stroked it. Guillaume was breathing with difficulty and an erratic gasp. Then little Blanche threw herself across him, took a pillow, pressed it firmly over his swaddled face, and slid open a Judas hole, originally sealed, above the bed. The bastard's black face shot through the opening. He snuck in, discreetly. In a single bound, he had pinned Guillaume's chest down with his knees and dealt his head 1, 2, 3 blows with the cloven stick that he carried. The man emerged from under the sheets, and a horrible cry burst from his tumid mouth. But the barber, coming out from under the bed straps, tackled Bastouin as he opened the door, and the bastard slit Guillaume's throat with an ox-tongue blade he wore on his belt. The body went rigid and toppled onto the floor, taking little Blanche with it. She was pinned to the ground, splayed under the hot corpse, receiving the warm blood which poured over her neck because her dress was caught under her dying boyfriend, and she was screaming, but not strong enough to free herself. The vigilant barber helped little Blanche back to her feet, while the bastard scrambled on the water, and seeing, as Blanche d'Offrebourg, this Countess of Vassy was religious, she wiped her mouth and her husband's face with her picardie hood, laid it over his swollen face, and said in her childlike little voice, where 3 potters and then ice storm will do. That was Marcel Schwab. It's called Little Blanche, from The Man in the Golden from the man in the golden mask, the king in the golden mask, sorry. I'm trying to read things at once here. It's not working out. Okay, what am I reading first? Or am I reading it all? Okay, that book came out in 2017, but the reprint, I don't know. It's a reprint. Like I said, dude's long dead. But, I have about 15 minutes. The Irish fairy tales are too long to read another, but I can find a short one in the same collection of crazy tales. The Plague. I, Buonaccorso, the Neri di Pitti, son of Buonaccorso, Gonfanier of Justice in the Commune of Florenzi, of which the coat of arms was dressed in the year 1401 by an order of King Rupert in the city of Trento with the golden rampant lion. I want to recount for my ennobled descendants what befell me when I began to roam the land in search of adventure. In the year 1474, being a young man without money, I fled from Florence along the great highways with Matteo for companion, for the plague was devastating the city. The sickness was swift and attacked in the streets. The eyes burned and grew red, the throat sore, the stomach distended. Then the mouth and tongue were covered by little pockets of irritating water. One was obsessed by thirst. A dry cough shook the sick for several hours. Then the limbs went rigid at the joints, the skin piebald with yellow, with swollen red pox, which some have dubbed boboes, and in the end the faces of the dead were distended and whitish, with bleeding contusions and mouths open like cornets. The public fountains, nearly dried up from the heat, were surrounded by men hunched and gaunt, and who tried to dunk their hands. Many plunged straight in. Those were pulled out by chain hook, black with scum, their skulls crushed. The browning corpses littered the middle of the lands down, which of the lanes down which stream in season torrents of rain. The smell was intolerable. The fear was terrible. But Matteo loved to roll the dice, so we had quite a time there at the exit of the city, and we drank at the first inn some mixed wine to our health and mortality. Merchants were there from Genoa and Pavia, and we challenged them with dice cup in hand, and Matteo won 12 ducats. As for me, I invited them to a game of table, and had the good fortune of walking away with a gain of 20 gold florins, with which ducats and florins we purchased mules and a load of wool, and Matteo, who had deliberated traveling to Prussia, picked up a provision of saffron. We roamed the paths from Padua to Verona. We came back to Padua to furnish ourselves more amply with wool, and we traveled all the way to Venice. From there, passing the sea, we went into Sclavonia and visited the good cities at the Croatian border. In Buda, I took sick with fever, and Matteo left me alone at the inn with 12 ducats, returning to Florence, where certain business was calling him and where I was to join him again. I lay in a dry and dusty room on a bag of straw, with no doctrine but a door that gave unto the drinking room. On Saint Martin's night, there arrived a company of pipers and flautists, with some 15 or 16 Venetian and Teuton soldiers. After draining many a flank, crushing the pewter steins, and breaking the legs the jugs against the wall, they began to dance to the sound of life, of the fife. They peeked their ugly red mugs through the door, and seeing me laid out on my back, started to pull me into the other room, crying, "You drink, or you sink." Then swindled me while the fever pounded on in my head, finished with me by dumping me in the sack of straw, the opening of which they stitched shut around my neck. I sweated copiously, and thus no doubt lowered my temperature, whereas my anger soared. They had tangled up my arms and taken away my bacillar. Otherwise, I would have made a break for it, thorny with straw, through the soldiers. But on my left, I carried under my stockings a short and sheath blade. I succeeded in slipping my hand to it, and said, with its help, I slit open the fabric of his sack. Perhaps the fever was still causing my brain to swell, but the memory of the plague as we had left in Florence, and which had since passed to, who knows, mixed in my mind the sort of idea I had formed of the face of Sulfa, dictator of the Latins, of whom the great Cicero speaks. He resembled the Athenians, and blackberry powdered with flour. I resolved to terrify the Venetian and Teuton gendarmes when I found myself in the nook where the innkeeper locked up his prompt provisions. And conserved fruits, I quickly slashed a bag full of corn flour. I rubbed my face with this dust, and once I had taken to a complexion neither yellow nor white, with my blade I gave my arm a good scratch, from which I drew enough blood so unevenly blotch the coating. Then I got back into the sack, and I waited for the drunken reprobates. They came in, laughing and staggering. No sooner had they seen my white and bloody face that they crushed into each other, crying, "The plague! The plague!" I hadn't even gathered my weapons before the inn was empty. Feeling recovered from the sweat those ruffians had forced on me, I set out on the road for Florence to join back up with Matteo. I lost my page. It's a great technical difficulty. This analog device. I can't really search for a word. But before and after you get married, I guess. No. Damn. All right, well, clearly. I'm going to lose the page like that. All right. Anyways, I guess you've been listening to me, your host, Norman Douglas. And the name of the show is Good Night, Norman. It's almost time for me to go off the air, so I'd just like to find that page, but I'm not going to. I'm giving up on it. I wish I could plug something, but I don't know what's happening. I hope that you got a chance to see my the bird's nest that came to me. Okay. Just my companion, Matteo, wandering the Florentine countryside. Because they think the plague is going on. He hadn't dared go into the city, for the plague that continued to rage there. We turned back and made our way on a quest for riches toward the state of Pope Gregory. Heading up toward Avignon, we encountered bands of armed men carrying lances, pikes, and bouges. For the citizens of Bologna had just risen up against the Pope by request of the citizens of Florence, which we didn't know. We played joyous games of this and that sort with the people there, as many games of tables as of dice, so well that we won upwards of 300 ducats and 40 gold florins. The city of Bologna was almost entirely devoid of people, and we were received in the bathhouses with cries of jubilation. The chambers there are not covered with straw, as in many Lombard cities, and the filthy beds are not lacking there, though the straps are for the most part broken. Matteo ran into a Florentine girl he knew, Mona Giovanni. As for me, why didn't I think of asking the name of my girl? As for me, who didn't think of asking the name of my girl, I was happy with her. We drank in abundance there of chewy wine from the region and bitter beet. We ate jams and tartlets. Matteo, whom I had told of my adventures, feigning to step out, went down into the kitchen and came back disguised as a plague victim. The Sona girls fled on all sides, letting our high-pitched squeals, then gathered their wits. Then gathered their wits and came still petrified to touch Matteo's face. Mona Giovanni did not want to go back with him and stayed trembling in a corner, claiming his forehead was warm with fever. Meanwhile, Matteo, drunk, lay his head down among the pots right there upon the table.